This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
People are policy. That's it. That's the open. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday today, the very last day of November 2020. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There's a thing we started saying on this program maybe 5-6 years ago, before the last presidential election, for sure, that headlines about a strong economy are all well and good, but if people aren't feeling it in their daily lives, then it kind of doesn't matter. And I want to stress the people thing here, because that is where we start on this Monday. Those headlines, which are fundamentally about economic policies, right? Those headlines are made by people, as those policies are. And we learned some more today about the people who are going to be making economic policy in the Biden White House. Former Fed Chair Janet Yellen, as we have told you, is the pick for Treasury Secretary. Wally Adeyemo, a veteran of the Obama administration, is going to be nominated as Deputy Treasury Secretary. And the transition team also released the names of three people who will be on the President's Council of Economic Advisers today. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams takes it from there.
The name of the group may sound boring, I know, but who's on the Council of Economic Advisers matters a lot in terms of the policy coming out of the White House, says Jamin Spear, who teaches economics at the University of Memphis.
The Council of Economic Advisers is essentially the White House's own economic think tank. Or maybe you could say the academic arm of the White House.
The academic part of this crew coming in is Cecilia Rouse, who will lead the CEA. She served on the council under Obama and is a dean at Princeton. The other two members announced today come more from the think tank world. Jared Bernstein of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and Heather Boucher of the Washington Center for Equitable Growth.
The choices signal that you're going to see maybe some more outside-the-box policy ideas. Ideas that academics might think are a little bit out of the mainstream.
Thinking differently about the role of Wall Street and big corporations, how much debt is tolerable to achieve social goals. Seema Jayachandran is an economics professor at Northwestern University. She says it's notable all three are labor economists.
I see this as really signaling that getting people back to work, those improvements in economic well-being for the poorest Americans and racial minorities is going to be a top priority.
Having this particular group at the table for economic decision-making will also change which ideas are brought to the table, says former Fed economist Claudia Sahm, who also spent some time working at the CEA.
And so you'll see that in the type of analysis that the president and the White House gets. I truly believe that more diversity brings better economic policy.
If confirmed by the Senate, Rouse will be the first African-American woman to ever lead the CEA. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
A very quick entry in the What is Janet Yellen Thinking sweepstakes today from the nominee herself in her very first tweet. We face great challenges as a country right now, she said. To recover, we must restore the American dream, a society where each person can rise to their potential and dream even bigger for their children. I mean, yes, obviously to all of that, but that is way more than five words. I'm just saying. Okay, to corporate news now, the mergers and acquisitions desk. S&P Global, yes, that S&P of 500 index fame, has agreed to buy IHS Markit in an all-stock deal worth about $44 billion. Lots of ways to talk about this story. It's a big one. And we chose this, that these companies are two of the biggest data providers to Wall Street. We asked Marketplace's Andy Euler to explain what that's going to mean for traders and for the computers that they've got doing most of the work.
Trading on Wall Street these days is different from what it used to be even 15, 20 years ago.
It's my computers fighting against your computers.
That's PK Jain. He teaches finance and artificial intelligence trading at the University of Memphis. He says the task before portfolio managers is often to analyze corporate data coming from different sectors across many time zones.
And to put together that data historically from different vendors has been a challenge. So that challenge is less if you have fewer data vendors and those who are providing you with the raw material to process and analyze.
He says that's the good news, a more centralized data provider. Daniel Ives at Wedbush Securities explains there's also a downside.
In this increasing technology ecosystem, data's really become the gold for Wall Street.
He says S&P knows this.
They're doing it ultimately because it's going to centralize, give them more pricing power and something that they could charge more for.
Full disclosure, S&P is a marketplace underwriter. Ives says this merger means less competition for the data Wall Street needs, which has some wondering whether federal regulators will allow it.
I think two large companies should always be interested in explaining to regulators why this is not anti-competitive.
Michael Goldstein teaches finance at Babson College. He says there are other players out there, though.
They have a big competitor in Bloomberg, right? So it's not like there aren't other competitors for them. They all provide slightly different services, but I'm sure the regulators will look increasingly closely at that.
He says S&P and IHS Markit may argue the companies are complementary businesses, so having the services under one roof is good for efficiency. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
S&P's 500 stock index down a bit today. The Dow down a little bit more. The NASDAQ basically flat on the session. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As this pandemic stretches on and on, Medicaid is becoming all the more important. The federal and state program helps cover medical costs for children and people with disabilities and low-income Americans. And as Medicaid enrollments rise, so too does the financial peril for a lot of states. Marketplace's Erica Barris explains what's going on there.
As millions of people have lost their jobs in this pandemic, many have also lost their health insurance. Joan Alker is the director of the Center for Children and Families at Georgetown University.
Medicaid has really been a first responder in the COVID-19 pandemic, both from a health perspective and an economic perspective.
As of July, 4 million more people enrolled in Medicaid than were on the rolls in February. And that number keeps growing. With all those new enrollees, added expense. For most states, Medicaid makes up around one-third of the state budget. With less income tax coming in, less sales revenue, and a slew of unexpected pandemic expenses, states are strapped. Robin Rudowitz with the Kaiser Family Foundation.
Governors are working on putting together budgets for the upcoming fiscal 2022, which begins July 1st, and they will have to assume that that fiscal relief is not available.
The federal government typically matches state expenditures 50-50. But for people who got Medicaid through the Affordable Care Act expansion, the government covers 90%. States also got extra federal money for Medicaid through the CARES Act in the spring. Sarah Rosenbaum is a health law and policy professor at George Washington University. She says states are looking for any place they can trim.
Probably the number one thing states are strategizing around is cutting provider payments or deferring provider payments in order to free up money.
Or losing health benefits like dental or vision. James Nash of the National Governors Association says if states can't make more trims in Medicaid, other vital services could be cut.
We're talking about K-12 and higher education. We're talking about corrections and public safety.
So states are doing some hard math. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
For your listening pleasure tomorrow morning, might I recommend the Marketplace Morning Report, David Brancaccio and the gang. Everything you need to know to start your economic day. There was a study in the journal Nature not too long ago, looking at where people are most likely to be exposed to the coronavirus. Among the conclusions, that people from disadvantaged racial and socioeconomic groups have a harder time avoiding places where they are likely to be exposed, including, as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports, places where they go to buy food.
When Crystal Orange goes into one of the corner stores in her Chicago neighborhood to grab some groceries, it is not easy to keep her distance from other people.
They have tiny stores. The lines are going down the aisles. So if someone's shopping, have to continue to say, excuse me, excuse me, excuse me, due to the fact that someone is standing in the line down the aisle.
But those tiny stores are her only options if she wants to get groceries without getting in the car. In the neighborhood where she lives,
we have nothing but gas station shopping, corner store shopping, and of course, liquor stores.
And all of them, she says, are usually pretty crowded. So are the bigger grocery stores she drives to for most of her shopping. That crowding is one of the main reasons the study in Nature found that people in low-income neighborhoods are twice as likely to be exposed to COVID at the grocery store as people in high-income neighborhoods.
Because these grocery stores visited by lower-income individuals have a higher number of people per square feet, and also their visitors stay a bit longer.
Serena Chang is a PhD student at Stanford and the lead author on the paper. And she says in the 10 large metro areas she and her colleagues studied, on average,
grocery stores visited by lower income individuals have 59% more people per square feet, and their visitors stayed 17% longer.
People who are lower income and maybe living paycheck to paycheck also tend to go food shopping pretty often, says Daniel Block, a professor of geography at Chicago State University.
The fact that they just might not have as much money available to them in any particular week might mean that they have to go out more often to buy food.
Which, he says, means more exposure to the virus. And that, in general, is something people with money have been able to avoid if they choose to, says Steph Funk of the Chicago Food Policy Action Council.
When we look at who has the privilege to work from home, when we look at who's forced to travel longer distances to get food, and then maybe even compare that to someone who can afford to have food delivered into their houses, it becomes a little more clear why low-income communities are experiencing higher rates of COVID.
And grocery stores, more than almost anywhere else, she says, are unavoidable for a lot of people.
Unlike eating out at a restaurant or going to a bar, like those things are things you can remove from your life, but folks are forced in a lot of cases to get food from a grocery store.
Whether or not it's crowded. In Chicago, Crystal Orange generally goes to the store a few times a week to shop for herself and also for her mom, who's in her 70s and very worried about COVID.
She's very paranoid. She's very paranoid.
Orange is worried, too. She doesn't want to pick COVID up somewhere and risk bringing it home to her mom. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I mean, you always got to have the newest and fastest, right?
Sometimes, though, what you got to have isn't what you get. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, here you go. Dow Industrial's down 271.9%, closed at 29,638. The NASDAQ down 7 points, next to nothing percentage-wise, 12,198. S&P 500 down 16, just about a half percent, 36 and 21. Cyber Monday, hey, it's today, by the way, is set to break all kinds of records, up into the double-digit billions. Looking ahead, though, tomorrow is Giving Tuesday. COVID-19 has put the squeeze on a lot of nonprofits this year, but employee matching and giving programs give a serious boost to many causes. 84% of donors say they're more likely to give if their gift is matched. That's according to the nonprofit America's Charities. And here is some incentive for you. Somewhere between $4 and $7 billion in corporate matching funds goes unused every single year. That's according to the nonprofit Double the Donation. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Thanksgiving weekend is typically one of the big movie weekends. Last year, In the before times, Frozen 2 made $124 million at the box office over the five-day holiday. Some of those, by the way, were my dollars. This year, of course, is not last year. The Croods, A New Age, led with just $14 million, none of which were my dollars. Stephanie Silverman is one of the 10 people we are following in our series, The United States of Work, and she has got her own box office to worry about. She's the executive director of the nonprofit Belcourt Theater in Nashville, Tennessee, which just this month reopened for in-person screenings. Stephanie Silverman, it is good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, Kai Rizdahl.
First of all, before we get to the marketplace of this, how you doing? I mean, how you doing? How you doing?
You know, hanging in. We had a lovely Thanksgiving, although it, you know, we were supposed to go visit all our older kids in Chicago and had to cancel that and hunker down at home. But all in all, okay.
Yeah, I get it. How's the mood at the business? I mean, it's you're open, but it's not easy.
Right. It's slow for sure. But, you know, I guess there's a certain sense of optimism just that we feel like we figured out how to do this safely, right? The way to open, the way to keep patrons apart from each other, yet together in a space watching a movie with numbers going up and still these conversations around whether or not you should wear a mask or, you know, it just complicates the ability to do things safely and still inspire enough confidence in audiences, right?
Yeah. So let's talk about the logistics of this, first of all. How many people does the Belcourt Theater fit in normal times? What's capacity?
Our largest seats 332 people. The second space seats 255. So both quite large, especially for movie theaters. And in both of them, the maximum number of people we're seating is 56. So that's like 17% of the capacity of the largest hall and 22 of the next one down. So, I mean, it's a tiny capacity, but I took my son to see a movie and it still felt like you were watching a movie with people, which is really, right, the defining part of the theater experience, being in community with people.
I imagine you're not turning them around. You know, you go to the multiplex, and as soon as you walk out, there's a whole crew there waiting to come in and clean and turning it around for 15 minutes later. I'm sure that's not happening at the Belcourt, right?
That is not. We are taking a full hour between each screening to really get that hall sanitized. We're trying to really calm down, right? To like, to not follow all the normal movie theater operating rules and just go slow and carefully so that we really know we're checking off all the boxes.
One of the normal movie theater operating rules, though, is that you got to make money doing this. Are you making money doing this?
Well, so not, not by ticket sales alone, for sure. Like, we sold, you know, north of 300 tickets over the holiday weekend. And I just looked at what we sold the year before and it was north of 1700 tickets.
Oh, wow.
So the lucky thing for the Belcourt is that we're a nonprofit. And so during this whole period, we've had to sort of turn our model around and lean more on philanthropy than on earned income. But, you know, we are able to do this because we have members who keep donating. We got a big gift from Amazon, which has helped just keep us operating. It's
Amazon?
Yeah, Amazon. They have, you know, they're building a big distribution center here in Nashville, and they have sort of stepped up in the corporate philanthropy world here in the city. And they, you know, they helped us with our safety precautions, you know, those kinds of things that the corporate community has stepped in to help us, frankly, where the federal government has not, has allowed us to have our doors open because it is not based on popcorn and ticket sales alone.
Right. Stephanie Silverman in Nashville, she runs the Belcourt Theater there. Stephanie, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time and best of luck to you.
Thanks, Guy. Much appreciated.
The chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, Ajit Pai, announced today he is going to be stepping down come Inauguration Day. Pai's legacy is complicated. There was the whole net neutrality repeal. Pai thought, and the FCC ruled, that market pressures, not regulation, ought to be the thing to force internet companies to treat all online traffic equally. More recently, he has auctioned off big chunks of the airwaves, trying to get the much hyped but so far underwhelming next generation of wireless service known as 5G off the ground. It has been years that we've been hearing about 5G, its blazing speeds and limitless possibilities. So, where is it? Marketplace's Sabri Benishour went a-looking.
Well, I found it. It's here on Matt Ferris's phone.
I got the new iPhone 12 Pro, and I have Verizon with the 5G service. I mean, you always got to have the newest and fastest, right?
Right. About that. So it turns out that his 5G does not feel that new or that fast.
Seems to be consistent with what I had before.
The 5G only comes with the more expensive unlimited data plan Ferris is on, by the way. Now, once in a while, randomly, he'll get a signal for super fast 5G.
I did have some success last Saturday. I was on the roof of a building in downtown DC and got the signal and tested it out, and it was blazing fast.
Like 60 times faster than normal. But he couldn't really tell from his apps.
It's one of those things where it's fun to know that you have it, I guess.
Not quite the revolution we were promised.
A lot of people feel like kids in the back of the car asking, are we there yet? And the answer is no, we're not there yet.
Roger Entner is founder of Recon Analytics, a telecom and media research and analysis firm. The reality right now is this. Super fast 5G exists, but it is rare. The signal doesn't go far, so it's only close to special antennas. You might find them like by a stadium, but not two blocks away. Lower speed 5G is more common, but not everywhere. It depends on the wireless company. More coverage will come, and it'll get faster over the next few years. Different telecom companies have different types of 5G, and none of them cover the whole country. So, what has been the holdup?
One of the issues is the spectrum.
As in, the airwaves 5G travels on.
The bands that are the most suitable for it were already occupied here in the U.S.
The military and satellite companies, among others, controlled the ideal airwave real estate, and it has taken decades of negotiation, sharing agreements, and new technology to pry it out of their hands. Another issue, there's a lot of physical construction involved in building a 5G network. Dan Hayes is with PwC Strategy Consulting.
A typical mobile network operator in the United States may have anywhere from 50 to 100,000 cell sites today. And virtually every one of those will have to be upgraded to 5G.
And all that construction and all those cranes and all those technicians do not pay for themselves. Will Townsend is head of networking practice for more insights and strategy.
Verizon and AT&T are both on record stating that their investment in building out their 5G mobile networks will be in excess of $20 billion. Those operators have to recoup that investment.
And here we get to the slow beating heart of 5G. Where is the money? Because how quickly and how much telecom companies spend building 5G networks depends on how quickly and how much they think they'll earn.
We know investors are at this point not convinced.
Alex Holt is global head of tech, media, and telecoms at KPMG. Maybe telecoms will start making their money back by charging more on people's cell phone bills.
Trying to extract more dollars for 5G has yet to be proven.
In fact, surveys show only a minority of consumers would do that right now. Another option, charge businesses.
It's a slightly new path, but we do believe in it.
It's up in the air. But functional, fast 5G networks are not a matter of if, they are a matter of when and how quickly. 5G is the future, and that is the best part about it and the worst part about it. We don't know the future. Bill Menezes is a director analyst with Gartner.
You know, kind of the same way when 4G was launched a decade ago, I don't think anybody was saying, oh, great, this is going to let us create Uber. Those are things that developers have helped make happen once they got a sense of what the 4G network was going to be capable of and kind of took it from there.
The problem is 5G has been hyped to death for years. So until we get doctors performing retina surgery in LA over 5G from New York and swarms of semi-sentient self-driving cars picking up the kids from school, we're just going to have to be a little disappointed for a while. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace. A
I mean, I know they're coming, but I'm not sure I want swarms of semi-sentient self-driving cars like right now, right? Anyway, this final note on the way out today, which comes with this advisory that according to the TSA, the Sunday after Thanksgiving last year was the busiest travel day of 2019. 2.88 million people spent time on an airplane that day. The Sunday after Thanksgiving this year, 1.17 million people took a plane ride, setting aside for a minute the relevant public health warnings, which I probably ought not do, actually. That was, Sunday was, the busiest travel day of this pandemic so far. Okay, we're out. Here is your Monday moment of economic context, a nod to the reality that the virus is the economy right now. The head of production and distribution for Operation Warp Speed, which is, of course, the Trump administration's vaccine plan, said today on MSNBC, and this is a quote, 100% of Americans that want the vaccine will have had the vaccine by June. So light, end of tunnel, eventually. Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Honhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios are our daily production team. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.